some of my songs I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Today is Tuesday, September 28th, 2010. There's a tornado coming to Brooklyn, and we're part of it. I'm Jimmy Carbone, your host. Ray Dieter's my co-host, and our special once-a-month roving reporter, Dave Broderick, is in the house. Beer Sessions Radio is sponsored by GreatBrewers.com. It's one of the top beer sites, and it represents over 50,000 beer retailers in 14 states, and we're supported by the people at the Good Beer Seal, GoodBeerSeal.com, an association of New York City good beer bars. Let's cut to the chase. We got Ray Dieter and Dave Broderick in the house, and a very special guest tonight, Mr. Dave Geary, one of the deans of American craft beer. When I was first starting out back in the 90s, it seems like we all started out in the 90s, 1994, DVA opened, everyone went to Ray's Bar. Blind Tiger was starting, my little restaurant was starting back then. And we were all drinking Geary's beer. We got some London Porter in front of us tonight. But Dave, I just want to say hello and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jimmy. It's great to be here.
We feel honored to have you. Ray, when did you first ever try Geary's beer?
The first time I tried Dave Geary's beer, I read about it in Michael Jackson's guides, but I had the Hampshire Special Ale, and I was up in Rochester, and we were at the Old Toad, and it was a cask ale, and I had flown up there especially to taste the cask ales that were being presented at the Old Toad, and I went up there, and I spent the weekend in Rochester, and I drank a lot of your beer, Dave.
Well, the Old Toad was great. They came to Portland with a truck. Mm-hmm. And they were all wearing masks and were armed. And that relationship was great until the powers at the government discovered the illegal activity and shut them down. But that was our first entry into cask-conditioned beer, and as far away as New York.
I have no idea that there's any illegal activity surrounding this business.
We don't do that anymore.
I've never heard of such a thing.
I think that was all. There's a big shakeout back there about 95, and we're finished with that. It's all behind us.
I know that no one these days is breaking any of the liquor laws.
It's just not an option.
It's not an option.
Yeah. But he didn't call the Hampshire Ale Hampshire Ale. He called it Whippet Ale.
Right.
Because he's from Yorkshire, the guy that ran the place.
Exactly. I said, I don't care what you call it.
Is he in jail now? Or is he out?
I think he's dead.
Okay.
I don't care what you call it. Just buy it.
Just buy it, right.
If the check clears, I'm a happy guy.
Oh, well, it's in cash. You don't have to answer that. It's okay.
So Dave Geary from Geary's. Dave, are you a Mainer? You're from New England?
Yes. I graduated from high school in Portland, Maine. And I went away to college in Indiana at Purdue, and was away for 9 years. I couldn't wait to get out of Portland, and I couldn't wait to get back.
We're glad you came back.
Yeah, and what made you want to start a brewery? I mean, how did you even get into that?
I met a brewer, Traquair House. The beer aficionados out there will be aware of Traquair House Ale. Brewed in a 350-year-old antique wooden stone floor brewery in a castle in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
And I met the brewer, who is the owner of the house, Peter Maxwell Stewart, the 20th Laird of Traquair, and he said to me, you know, if you ever want to do this, if you ever want to get involved in a small commercial brewery, come to Scotland, and I will arrange everything. The company I was working for went bankrupt. I called him up. This was 1982. This is the winter of 1982.
I don't think I was born yet, Dave.
I'm sure, looking at you, looking at that hair, I'm sure you weren't. Do you color that, Ray?
No, don't even talk
about
it.
All right.
It's radio.
So I
Ray's single. He has to color his hair.
Right. And I called him up, and I said, is your offer still good? And he said, yes, come to Traquair. And I did in the winter of 83. I spent 4.5 months in Scotland down to the south coast of England with a little bit of study at Harriet Watt University Graduate School of Brewing. I worked at Belhaven, Traquair, of course. I was there in the castle for a month. Tadcaster in Yorkshire for Samuel Smith's.
You worked at Samuel Smith's?
I did.
They let you in there?
Barely, but only because the Laird was a personal friend of the Smiths.
Right.
And vouched for me. But they were very secretive people.
Yes.
Very. But they welcomed me with open arms.
David, I'm really impressed by that. Because I've tried to get a tour there. I've tried.
And those slate squares with the beer stone peeling off the sides. And that's where it was in Scotland that I learned to be fearless, and in England, to be fearless about brewing. And if you do it right, you don't have to have these sterile operating room German-type breweries. The Germans, Michael Jackson famously said that the Germans wanted to invade Belgium to make them clean their breweries. And I worked at Bass, and I worked at David Bruce.
I know David.
The Firkin series of brew pubs of Frog and Firkin, the Ferret and Firkin, the
Go Pheasant
and Firkin, on and on. And that's where I got some brew pubs.
And he had the Slug and Lettuce series.
Oh, that's good.
Well, he had, what's it, Dog Bolter.
Dog Bolter. That was his high-gravity beer, yeah.
That was high-gravity beer. And I finished up at a small brewery in Hampshire called Ringwood, where I finally was brewing to the scale I was looking at.
So what's your association with Alan Pugsley?
I hired Alan. Alan Pugsley was working for the Ringwood Brewery.
Of course.
And I hired him to come to the United States and work for me for 2 years because he was a professional brewer. I didn't, after 4.5 months, I certainly didn't have the depth of knowledge and skill that I needed to continue. And I figured in 2 years I would.
Right.
And so who was brewing, you know, it was 1985 here in the States. Who was brewing around the country at that time?
There were about probably 18 or 20. Sierra Nevada, Red Hook.
Brooklyn hadn't started yet.
Brooklyn hadn't started yet. Actually, Newman's in Albany, New York was brewing at that time. A place in Virginia, whose name escapes me. But there were a few... Mostly on the West. Rocky's Brewing was brewing.
Were you guys in contact with each other at all, or was it just sort of everybody on their own?
We did.
Bert Grant was there.
We actually did. By 1987, when the Association of Brewers had their first Microbrewers Conference. God, that name seems archaic now, Microbrewers. the first one was held that I attended was in Boston in 1987. And it was held in a phone booth, essentially. there were very few of us, fewer than 30 in the country. And it was, we all knew each other. We were all on a first name basis. And we all hated each other.
So it was a short meeting.
So how'd you make it this far? That's the real question.
Well, I don't think there's a simple answer to that. I was speaking to someone today, and I said, you know how people say you're not supposed to have any regrets? I got a couple. I made some bad choices. I essentially missed opportunities. I made some really good choices with the people that I associated with. Our distributor network are very good customers. Plus, we make really, really good beer.
You do.
And that's... the sine qua non, if you don't, you're screwed. You're out of business. That's why brewers like Cartwright went out of business. Red Hook changed their tune big time because they had this ethyl acetate, horrible banana beer that was their first beer. It was awful. But it's like a restaurant. Jimmy, you know this. You know, if you make good food, people will come back. If you don't, you're out of business. So, first and foremost, quality, consistency. Second, taking care of business, taking care of the money coming in and the money going out, taking care of every part of it. And eternal vigilance, especially in the marketplace, being able to go to accounts, see what's on the shelf, see if you're getting screwed by your distributor, which never happens.
No, 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 no. Dave, I've got a question for you. How many states is your beer available?
17.
17, all in the East?
All in the Northeast.
Right.
East and Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
Down as far as South Carolina, as far west as Michigan.
Because I know for a while it was hard to find your beer, but in the past like year or so, it's been much more prevalent.
Well, we work hard at that. I mean, that's what we do. We're in the business of selling beer. And if we're not selling beer, enough beer, figure out why and change it.
Yeah, and I read a great interview by you back in 1996 where you made some famous predictions, all of which came true, about how there were too many breweries at the time and too much bad beer. And then, lo and behold, 2 years later, a lot of them went out of business, which, and you said would make the business stronger, which it did. And so I'm kind of wondering if you have any other predictions about what you see out there now and, how you feel about this business.
I think the business is vibrant. We've had a tough couple of years as an industry. There are pockets of people doing really, really well. Pabst Blue Ribbon is off the charts because in this stressed economy, people are trading down a lot. And that goes for food, restaurants, lodging, and beer. And we've been under a lot of pressure because of the cost of our commodities. Our malt and hops have skyrocketed. They're beginning to moderate and go back down. So the business climate is a lot more favorable than it was 3 years ago. 3 years ago was very stressful because we had to make money. We don't have any option of losing money. So when we reach a certain price point, we start to get pushback, and that's when people started trading down. And we felt a big pinch in the last 2 years, but this year we're coming back strong. It's very
so. What's
good.
Your prediction for the industry in general?
For the
industry,
I think
the craft brew industry.
I think the craft brew industry is going to do well. I think the business is diluted among a lot of players. When we look nationwide at the percentage of the total beer market, it's single figures. It's 8%.
Right.
That's not a lot of beer. And we have we've got 1,800 breweries vying for that 8%. So
1,800 craft breweries right
yes.
now?
Yes, yes.
And how much has that grown in the past 10 years?
I'm not sure. I can tell you, when I started, when we first incorporated in 1983, there were 16. When we started brewing in 86, there were 28.
Right.
So it's
been exponential.
It's been exponential.
Wow.
And that's really good. It's really good for the beer industry. It's really good for the restaurant business because beer has finally made it into the spotlight as a credible beverage for fine dining.
It is. And you see great beer now in great restaurants here in New York City. Gramercy Tavern's got a great beer selection. A lot of the great
So does DBA.
Do. Well, thank you.
And Jimmy's as well.
And so does Portland. A lot of the restaurants in Portland, Maine have some great beer lists.
They do.
Well, Portland, Maine was named the foodiest small town in America recently, and it's very, very true. Nationwide, 8% craft beer out of the total beer market. Portland, Maine, probably 25 to 28% is craft beer.
Wow.
In Portland, Maine.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. And there are a few pockets like that. I think Portland West. Portland
and the amazing
Oregon,
thing about all the beers that are made up there, they all go great with lobster rolls.
Everything goes great with lobster rolls. And we've got our friend Luke Holden down here with Luke Lobster.
I live right down the street from Luke's place. I love his lobster rolls.
Luke's yeah, lobster.
I can't believe that people in New York will pay $12 for a lobster roll, but I guess that's...
How about 25?
Yeah, he's cornered it. He's got the cheapest ones around.
And the best.
Dave, let me ask you this. Since we're talking about Portland, let's tell us a couple good places to drink beer in Portland.
Well, probably the premier beer bar in Portland is the Great Lost Bear on Forest Avenue.
That's a great joint.
They have 75 taps, and I don't know how they do it. It's all in a phone booth, and it's all very crowded, but they keep up to date, and it is the best for variety in the city of Portland. Beyond that, man, you could name Rira, the Irish pub has great beer selection. Brian Baru, another Irish pub, great beer selection. $3 Dewey's, great beer selection. Bullfini's, great beer selection.
Navari Res.
Navari Res, well,
Uh-oh.
Well, a great beer selection if you like extreme Belgian beers.
Ah, okay.
But beyond that, it's not a lot of variety.
So when you're talking about a good beer, how do you get, let's just say if you have 75 taps or 12 taps, this is something that comes up sometimes. You know, there's a great bar in New York called Spite and Dival. They only have 6 taps. And some places I know, like at my place, Jimmy's number 43, we have 12 taps. And other places have 20 or 40, 75. I mean, do you think the numbers matter? Do you think that a place can keep up with that many different beers?
I don't think it matters to the bar owner. I tell people that, I'm going to open a bar and I want to have 24 taps. And I said, no, you don't. You want to have 10 or 12. With 24, you're not going to sell any more beer. You're going to have inventory tied up. You're going to have space tied up. You will not sell one drop more beer with 24 taps over 12. You won't, because people will come and they're not going to leave. They're going to find something they like. So it's if you're all about having a lot of taps, if that's your deal, that's fine. But adding taps, and distributors will come in and say, we can put another shank on this tower and you can pour this beer. And I think the bar owner should resist that.
So you think that Dave and I have been screwing up all these years?
Well, I like to drink more than 10 beers in a night, so I want more choices.
You want 10 different ones?
Dave, did you always have, when you had your first Blind Tiger, how many taps did you have?
24.
24.
Yep.
Do you still have 24, Dave?
28.
28. I have 16. I like 16.
I got more than you.
Size doesn't matter, Dave.
All I know is I have 12, and guys, there's nights when, four of them, turn over at once, and you have to verbal all the changes, and you're like, you know what? I'm glad I only have 12.
Yeah.
I think Jimmy's got the right model.
Whatever. That's why we brought Dave.
I'm not going to argue with you guys. You have.
It's got a New England sensibility. I think tonight actually has a New England theme. A little later on, we have Pretty Things, which is a gypsy brewery in Boston, coming on. And we've got Maine, and I'm a secret Red Sox fan. I am from New England, too. So watch. And Dave Broderick here lives up in Vermont now.
I live in Vermont. Yeah, that's right.
We're going to learn more about it. We'll come back in a few minutes, take a little break here. We'll learn more about how New Englanders know how to make things work on Beer Sessions Radio. Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I've got my great co-hosts tonight. I got Dave Broderick and Ray Dieter, and with special guest Dave Geary from Geary's Brewing up in Maine. We're having a really good time. I think it's a good time to ask the question. We get email questions every week from our interested listeners, and this is from P. Clark in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. I'm interested in cellaring beer. Could you give me any tips and guidelines? Silence.
For cellaring beer, don't do it, man. The only beer you should cellar is a bottle-conditioned beer. Yeast still in the bottle. The yeast is a great oxygen scavenger, and I don't care how good your bottling system is. If you've got oxygen, you will get oxidation. Go ahead and cellar a bottle-conditioned beer. I have a Royal Thomas Hardy 1983. I have two of them in my cellar. And they said you're supposed to lay it down for 25 years. Now it's been 27, and I'm still not going to open it.
So what's the occasion that's going to occur to justify opening that kind of a special thing?
Great. Like,
if I ever get married again.
Oh.
Which means...
So you're going to save this for your kids?
Yeah. It's going on eBay.
Yeah, and I would also say, you know, over at least over 8%, you know, something a little bit stronger.
Some alcohol in it.
Yeah.
So bottle condition. Well, I mean, what does Cellary mean? I mean, I know like Garrett Oliver at Brooklyn. I've had some of their like the Brooklyn Schneider Weiss comp, you know, partnerships, and you know, having those kegs a year later, they've really softened and mellowed. I mean, is that considered laying down?
Well, it depends on what you mean by softening and mellowing. People bring me Hampshire or Hampshire Special Ale, which is 7% alcohol, pretty sturdy brew, and they bring it to me and say, "Taste how mellow this is." And I taste it, and I'm old school. I taste it. And I said, "It's not as good as it was. It's like bread. It's fresher is better." Now, high gravity with yeast present, it's a different story, because it continues to condition and it continues to mature. Anytime you get a sherry-like flavor from a beer, mm-hmm. it's oxidized.
Is the Hampshire beer filtered? The Hampshire Special Ale?
Yes, it is.
It's not bottle conditioned.
We don't do any bottle conditioned beers.
Have you thought about it?
Briefly.
And then you dismissed it.
Well, then I
is that one of the regrets?
I sobered up and decided it was a bad move. Look, a hipster.
Here we are. There's lots of them around here.
A hipster sighting?
Dave's down from Maine. But
yeah.
Here we are, Roberta's in Brooklyn. You got hipsters and tornadoes. All right, Dave, we're going to have to kick you out.
Just can I just ask one thing of Dave and Ray and you, Jimmy? Would you guys be willing to put my beer on tap at your establishments?
Now you're pushing.
Well, yeah, that's my job.
Ray, love English style beer.
I do love English style beer. No, and
it's you're like the biggest fan.
I do sell your beer, Dave.
On draft?
On draft.
Well, I didn't know that.
See?
we're drinking the
never
Gary's,
ask a question unless you know the answer.
Gary's London Porter. I think we've all had it on draft.
Yeah, we've all had it.
I think I have a draft right now, actually.
At the Old Tiger, I definitely had it.
But it's my job, Dave. It's my job to ask.
That's true.
And now that I've asked, I'll shut
We will
up.
Definitely have it.
All right, thank you.
And the answer is yes.
Thank you.
Did you do your job, Dave, Geary?
I don't know. You haven't had an answer from you yet, Jimmy.
I've had Geary's on draft.
He's only got 12 taps.
Yeah, I only have 12, you know. I've got Pretty Things on right now, which is our next guest.
All right.
Okay, so I'm not as good.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks, David.
We got some other guests.
We got Dan Paquette with his wife, Martha. They're from the Pretty Things Brewery. It's a gypsy brewery based up in the Boston area. It's another New England brewery. Let's switch over headphones, and we're here in a limited studio capacity. But we love the Heritage Radio Network, and this is a really cool show tonight. We've got New England brewers here. The other night at Jimmy's number 43, Sam Merritt from Civilization Beer, he co-hosted a nice dinner with some nano breweries, a microbrewery, and a gypsy brewery. And the gypsy brewery was Pretty Things. Dan, well, tell us a little bit more about yourself, how you got started, and, you know.
Okay, kind of well, yeah, I started brewing professionally just in 1992. I worked in a lot of those breweries that in New England went out of business over the years. I worked in a lot of breweries that got close to being out of business many, many times, and came back from the brink, and I think are still around. Somebody's gesturing towards.
We need an opener.
It's the opener. Okay.
We actually drink
so
beer.
So want to try one of your beers?
Oh right, yeah. You know what? I have keychain here with me. All right.
So Dan, you brewed at Ipswich, the Pilgrim Brewing Company, Mill City Brewing, John Harvard's Brew House, Northeast Brewing Company, the right. Tap, aka Haverhill Brewery,
right.
Daleside Brewery, and the Concord Brewery.
Right.
It says Pretty Things are the stuff we make beer out of: a grass, a weed, a fungus, and water.
That's right.
And you've got this kind of post-Victorian mustache.
Well, we're doing. Yeah, that's exactly it. It's not the beer we've just broken open here, but we've recreated a beer from 1901, which is about 3 months post-Victorian into the Edwardian era.
I believe I have a cask of that at DBA this evening.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Looking
I think
forward
it's,
to that.
It did arrive.
DBA Brooklyn.
This is Craft Beer Week, and this is one of our best lineups of brewers yet. We got Dave Geary. We got Dan Paquette. Ray, what else is going on at your place this week?
Well, tonight, I'm really looking forward to tonight. We have a lineup of Pretty Things beers versus Stinky Cheese. And Martin Johnson from the Bedford Avenue Cheese Shop in Williamsburg kind of curates the cheese, and I put together the beers, and it's going to be a great tasting this evening. And then tomorrow night, we're having an event called Beer to Patio. I'm sorry, Beer to Garden, and it's a bunch of great beer. We have some stuff from Southampton. We'll have some stuff from Pretty Things also, and all the proceeds are going to go to a lot of the local farmers. It's going to be a great event.
I have a question for Dan, and at what we're having right now, the mm-hmm. Jack Dora, I think, is this the first beer that you made?
This is, yeah. It's we're 18 batches, I think, into it now.
And who does your labels?
Martha and I draw the labels.
Really?
It was one of those things. Here's how the business started. It's kind of interesting. We moved back from England. We had a handful of money. You know, I've been a brewer too long to think I can afford to build a brewery. But I also got sick of working for other people. And we brewed one batch of beer in somebody else's brewery, drew the labels, got the beer on the market, then we were broke. So we couldn't afford an actual artist, and neither of us really fancy ourselves as illustrators of any kind, but it was out of necessity. And if you look at that label, if you know anything about Photoshop, that's a 480-layer Photoshop document. So I think we...
So you must have been popular with a printer.
No, yeah. But we can't do that all in one canvas, I should say. But we go to other people's breweries and we brew beer. We were going around to a bunch of different breweries. Pretty much have settled on a brewery in Westport, Massachusetts.
Buzzards Bay?
Buzzards Bay. We go there in the middle of the night.
Do they know you're there?
Yeah, they do know we're there. We're not totally vagrants. But we wake up at 1 o'clock in the morning. We get in the car. It's about a 62-mile drive. We're mashing in by about 3. We double batch so we can do 130 barrels in a day, which allows us to go away for New York Beer Week and things like this. So Jack Dore is a pretty simple beer. It's the four major ingredients and a little bit of sugar, not a lot of sugar, three yeast strains. All American hops and 6.5% alcohol.
I'm getting a bit of sourness to it. In a good way.
There's tartness from wheat.
That's probably it.
There's like that funkiness too, but it's like an earthy funkiness.
Is it malted wheat or
it's malted wheat. It's just straight up malted wheat. There's a little bit of Yorkshire oats. I put Yorkshire oats from Thomas Fawcett into pretty much everything I do.
Yeah, you, like Dave, have a little bit of an English connection in your past.
I think a lot of an English connection.
And a still,
with his wife sitting next to him.
And a still current English connection.
How about this? Let your wife talk for a minute, and she can even read from a document. Let's hear her accent. Listen, to, our listeners, if you love English accents, this is the accent.
This is a great one.
Oh, okay. I'm just here to give you my accent. No, I fancy myself as a brewer in training, and it's been really great. Being a partnership and doing all these beers together. And I think one of the things about our company is that we're allowed to be as creative as we like, because that's the advantage of being broke, is when it's your own money, you spend it all yourself, but nobody else is telling you what to do. So that's one thing that our beers have going for them.
So you're a scientist at MIT.
I was.
Oh, you were.
Now
you sneak into breweries late at night.
That's it. Now I spend my time trying to get into breweries and mashing in and milling in.
Are there a lot of breweries up in Massachusetts that would let someone like yourself go in and moonlight?
No.
Is it very rare?
That's a good answer to that.
Is it very rare?
Yeah, it's quite rare. I think we've been really lucky that people know Dan. Like, he's been brewing for quite a long time. He's quite an old man. And so people do know him well enough that they trust us to go in there. Because, you know, the big thing about our beers is we do make them ourselves. Like, Dan has to be the brewer. There's no point doing it otherwise, in our view. So we have had to find people who trust us.
What are the pluses and the minuses of being a gypsy brewer? It's definitely a different approach.
Yeah, it is a different approach. You know, some of the advantages are that if you use different breweries, you get different characters. So if you're trying to make a more hoppy beer, you might want a horizontal conditioning tank, for example, so you get lots of nice dry hop character. So you can try and play it like that, and we have tried to do that. Logistically, it does get tricky to be a gypsy brewer. It can be really complicated with trying to get beer picked up in different places and raw materials delivered to different breweries. So those are the advantages and disadvantages, I suppose. Yeah.
So if you're brewing at Buzzards, let's just...
Yeah.
And then you make the kegs. Do you leave them at Buzzards?
Usually they go straight out the door to our distributors. Yeah, our distributors are wanting more and more beer, and we're trying to keep up, which is really good for us and also for the brewery, so they don't have to store them. But we are able to store, you know, raw materials and bottles and all that. We buy all that ourselves. Yeah.
All right. Well, your beers are awesome. Last year you came out with the White Rabbit.
Yeah, that was a crazy
What was
one.
That?
The Fluffy White Rabbit.
Was it Fluffy? What was the real name
Fluffy
of it?
White Rabbit. So the name comes from Yorkshire, where I'm from, obviously. And in Yorkshire, we have a saying on the first of the month, the first thing that you should say should be White Rabbits, White Rabbits, White Rabbits. It gives you good luck for the month.
Because
so,
why?
so that's where the name came from.
For good luck. I mean, what's
it's this
got to be history to that?
Instead of just the foot.
I don't know where it comes from. Oh. Yeah, I guess from the rabbit.
Rabbit, foot. Not rare bit, right? Well, that's Welsh. That's Welsh.
That's Welsh. That's we don't
wait,
talk about it.
Martha, it's time for a toast. Say the White Rabbit three times and we'll all toast.
All right. White Rabbits, White Rabbits, White Rabbits.
Cheers.
Cheers.
So that's a little bit of the Yorkshire accent. We love that. I know it's about American men and English accents, but
well, yeah.
Dan, you're a lucky Ruben. Man. All right. A little bit of science, a little bit of MIT, and you get Pretty Things. What's the real name of the brewery? It's like something.
It's Pretty Things Beer and Ale Project. Well, you can't say brewing. You can't use the verb or the noun, can you? Or no, you can't use the noun. You can say brewing. Yeah, you can say brewing. But we decided not to do it because it sounded like a straight up contract, and we decided project because we thought we were going to be out of business in 3 months.
What like do you mean? Is it project? Like a legal thing? You can't say brewing.
Well, you can't say it's a brewery. Or what is it? Boston Beer Company, isn't it? Okay.
Oh, right.
It works like that. We didn't want to be beer company. I can't remember what it was.
And you can't say brewery at all in Massachusetts?
It's a federal thing. You can't say, yeah. If you don't have a brewery, we don't have anything. Oh. If you want to come and see Pretty Things, you have to come to our apartment. That's all we have.
What are we drinking here?
Okay. All right.
Wow.
Yeah, let's talk about this project.
Okay, so this is... You know, we do not entirely kooky beers with Pretty Things, but...
This is kind of kooky.
But this... The other thing that we do is we make a historical series of beers that are recreations of brew sheets. So not recipes, but we work with a historian named Ron Pattinson, who's based out of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. And he collects brew sheets... for a living, and he's sort of one of these guys who's all about statistics and uh-huh. Spreadsheeting. We've now chosen two different brews. This one's from November 15th, 1901. Was it originally brewed at Whitbread? And they made beer in a completely different way back then. This is just under 8%. Almost all of the color is from sugar.
Right. Molasses.
More or less. And the hops, they hopped beer in a totally different way as well. They used these very low alpha hops, and they used quite a lot of them. I think this is a 40-something barrel batch, and it's an 88-pound hop addition wow. for bittering.
Holy
crap. It's a $5,000 hop bill. And we were not interpreting this at all. We were just taking directly from what the Edwardians were doing.
$5,000 in 1901 dollars or $5,000?
No, in present. In current. And don't forget, the breweries back then were huge. The first beer we did was from Truman's from 1832, and that was originally a 1,500-barrel batch.
Wow.
Massive breweries. I don't think we have breweries like that anymore.
Just giant wooden casks? Is that what they put it into? Or
I can't tell you what they put it into, but I saw a drawing depicting a mashing out, and there was about 20 guys in what looked like a giant round swimming pool. It must have taken hours, and they were... there were several breweries like this, but this was, you know, cholera London, and, you know, there was 5 feet of foam on the Thames, and, it was a normal job to be to have a career pulling bodies out of the water and things like this. So, it was,
you know, I got to say, you might get the prize for the biggest beer geek we've had on yet. And we've had some big beer geeks on the show.
Certainly
over the
historical
past
geek.
Months.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think
maybe he's the best beer geek. From the 19th century.
Maybe that's it.
Well,
brought to life.
You've cornered that market.
I don't know. I just think it's worth, you know, it's kind of cool that we're talking about New England, and we're also talking a lot about England because
and old England,
I think
yeah.
people don't give English brewing enough credit these days.
I agree with that.
Because a lot of,
we know.
You know. Okay, yeah.
Ray, what's your favorite beer in the whole world?
I forget. Wait,
come on, Ray.
Come on.
Yeah.
Taras Bulba.
Good beer.
That's Dan's.
It's also an English style Belgian beer.
There was a lot going on, things might have changed a lot over the years, and we really associate them with, you know, only a couple of beer styles. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you go back into history, there's all kinds of things, and KK wasn't necessarily a brand name; it was more of a beer style back then. You know, I think the way that they pay duty is based on alcohol content. That's two Ks.
Okay.
So.
Don't want to get confused with any other case.
The refrigeration isn't what it is now, and were the beers a little bit more have a little bit more of a sourness to them?
Traditionally, well, in the sort of the era that we're talking about, the first beer that we did was mild, and they called beers that were served young, not sour. They called them mild. The flavor's mild. And then there was beers that would be sent to the back of the brewery, you know, aged and blended with younger beers to give them that sort of old, expensive flavor. KK would have been one of those sort of beers. And we resurrected it. We don't go into other people's breweries and infect it with lactobacillus, so we didn't do any of that. We were trying to be good guests. That's one part of being a gypsy brewer. You have to be a good guest.
Leave a little breath behind.
So,
like a Lone Ranger, silver bullet.
So, and I think it's a fun beer to drink. It is just under 100 BUs, which is a bit ridiculous, but if the Edwardians could do it.
And my understanding is that there's going to be a cask of this at DBA Brooklyn.
There is.
After this show.
Wow.
This evening.
There is.
And anybody that's out there listening, all hundreds of thousands of you, I'd love to see you at DBA this evening.
How many cask lines do you have?
We have three, and I think this is going to be on Gravity, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, Alex Hall's out there. He's, like, figured it all out for us.
Yeah.
Alex Hall, the master of Gravity kegs and all things cask.
All right. I love these New England brewers. This is awesome. We're taking another little short break on Beer Sessions Radio. Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We've got some great brewers here from New England. We've got Dave Geary from Geary's up in Maine and Dan Paquette from Pretty Things Beer and Ale Project in and around Boston. Well, on our break, we were talking about porter because we got, you know, talking about English beers. And Dave Geary, tell us about porters and what the hell are porters?
Porter is a uniquely London style. I happened to come across, actually it was someone who gave me a treatise from 1805 by a disgruntled brewer who said, every man his own brewer, I'm going to tell you how to make porter. And porter originated in the late 18th century in the Shoreditch region of London, which is the docks. And porters were the stevedores. They were the guys that unloaded the ships. And they had porter houses where this beer was sold. And it was a mild beer. It was a brown beer because they hadn't, the malt was, it was not refined. But it was very low in alcohol, and it was served in porter houses. School children drank it because milk was unknown as a beverage. We couldn't drink the water. So very low alcohol, mild beer called porter originated in this region.
Hey, Dave, when you say that the malt was unrefined, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, today the maltings are very sophisticated, very temperature controlled, moisture controlled.
Sure.
So you get a pale malt. And it used to be that that malts were darker.
They
were
I guess my question is that what differentiated a porter? Was it using a special unrefined malt, or is
it was just a name that stuck. And in this treatise, they talked about the stuff that they would put in it.
Mm-hmm.
Hot pepper in the wintertime, capsaicin.
Where do they get hot peppers in London?
I have no idea, but I'm reading about this.
Uh-huh.
Laudanum, which is opium.
I know what that is.
Yeah.
I'm sure in my beer.
I've read about it.
Yeah, I've read about it, too. And most interestingly, a substance called sativa.
I've heard about that stuff too.
Yes, and
wait, what's sativa?
It sounds like they had a Mexican connection.
Is that the indica? The hot peppers sativa? And the sativa.
I think it was probably Moroccan.
Moroccan.
And it was interesting that these porterhouses, and they talked about porterhouse steak, which I suspect is pot roast, the boiling the butts mm-hmm. of beef for the workers, and this beer was consumed morning, noon, and night.
So I bet it was.
So it was from these origins that I developed a recipe. It's totally modern recipe. I mean, there's no resemblance to the porter or threepenny or twopenny that was served in those days. But it was my inspiration. And 4 years ago, the New York Times tested 30, blind tasted 30
porters. I knew
you'd
get this in here.
You knew I'd bring that up. Didn't you? And Gary's was named the best porter available in New York, because it hit all the right notes, and we're very proud of that record.
And you should be. It's a great beer.
Yeah, but it's an interesting story, and now we have robust porters and Baltic porters, and I don't know what those are, but
well, apparently they all exist at the same time. The Baltic porters were from Eastern Europe, right?
I'm not aware of that. Eastern Europe, wouldn't they call them portiscas or?
I don't speak that language.
I don't either.
I have a hard time with English.
All right. So anyway, that's the background.
Well, they also put twigs in their beer. So.
The background of our porter mm-hmm. is distinctly London and distinctly late 18th century.
Well, you know, it's funny. One of the continuing questions that I always pose, not just on this program, but in my life everywhere I go, and I get boring too, is what's the difference between a stout and a porter?
That's your life question?
I know that I need a new life. I do, Dave.
As far as I'm concerned, and I'm no expert on styles. You'd have to ask.
You sound pretty good, though.
Charlie Papazian and
I've asked Charlie this question
and the style Nazis at the Great American Beer Festival. To me, it's roasted barley
instead of unrefined.
No, instead of malted barley, roasted barley, which gives it that astringent. Very stouty.
So you're saying that the grain in a porter is not roasted?
No, no. What I'm saying is that the grain, all of the grain in the porter is malted. All of the grain in a traditional dry stout is not malted. It's just roasted barley, whole barley, not malted.
Unmalted. Oh, yes. Oh, okay. Whoa.
That's my understanding. I'm no expert.
That's new information to me.
And you know,
when I asked Charlie, he just laughed at me.
Well,
he wouldn't answer it,
of course. But I think I'm about to be corrected. So.
Okay. No. I have no corrections. I'm not a style Nazi.
I wanted Dan to chime in. And what do you think? This is a modern porter. What would if he had David made this in 1850 London? Pick a date. Pick a year.
I don't know.
Would it be any different? How would it be different?
Well, I think it would still taste as good and probably be.
That's a cop-out.
No, I'm just saying, like, I don't know what these beers tasted like. Porter.
What do you think? I mean, a porter, like, you know, this is our modern version. How would this beer have been different if it was made in 1850?
I tell you what, I have no idea what these beers tasted. I have no idea what yeast strains that they were using. I have no idea how much contamination from bacteria.
You know, the water sucked.
The water really sucked, but they boiled it.
Yeah.
Well, at least that's a plus.
Right.
But, you're talking about foam and bodies floating, and where do they get their water? Who knows? I'll tell you what. The beer today tastes better than it did then. That's a
given.
Yeah.
We'll take that.
That's all we know.
Yeah. I think that's probably true. That's why we're doing this, to see what some of those old flavors are. One of the interesting things we found out in both of the beers that we've done, because of the high concentration of hops. The first batch we used whole leaf hops, and I told the owner of the brewery that I was going to destroy their brewery because there's so much hops.
Right.
And it was, that was only, it was just under 4 pounds of leaf hops per barrel. But,
okay, 4 pounds of leaf hops. How big is that in volume-wise?
Well, they're almost equal. Like, if you were to stack a barrel of beer and 4 pounds of leaf hops, there's not a big difference. And I'll tell you what, in the boil, I could have put a stick in. It would have stood up upright.
Right, yeah.
And then in this time around, there was a little bit more than that as far as hops go. But these recipes, there are recipes that go up upwards of 9 pounds per barrel that are coming from Ron's old recipes.
Who's Ron?
Ron Pattinson, the historian we work with. And these are actual brew sheets that
9 pounds of hops per barrel, and that's a 31
No, gallon. Well, this is translated to American barrels. Though their barrels are like 42 gallons. They're bigger 42 than
42 American gallons.
Yeah. Okay. But no, but this is translated already, so you don't have to do that math. But even with pellets, it was enough to clog up all the pumps. It's a miracle we were able to get
with
the water
pellets?
Into the... Even with pellets.
Okay, you said pellets. I mean...
The second time I had to use pellets because the first time it took two people 3 days to clean up the brewery. It was a royal mess.
Okay, so...
But the one thing, I just want to say the one thing that I've noticed is there's a quality that... even when I was brewing in England, I know whenever we'd have a boil over, the leaf would go on top of the kettle and it would sort of wort would caramelize, and I would taste it afterwards. After the day was done, I would taste it, and it was almost like a pipe tobacco quality. And I've noticed that here.
Is that
here,
a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, no, I've just noticed that there's a lot of caramelization on the outside of the leaf, and there's so much vegetal matter inside the kettle that you can taste almost this like pipe tobacco in the beer, and that's one of those old fashioned flavors you would never know could possibly exist if you didn't go down
that's
route.
That's fascinating to me.
Well, this is your KK beer. I mean, it definitely tastes like another time.
It definitely does, because the hops are not present like we're used to it at all, and you get this like maple syrup kind of molasses flavor to it. Like during the break, I mentioned it was like drinking like a rum beer. It reminded me of like Blackstrap from the Caribbean. In a good way.
Let's really take us back. 1901 was this beer that you make, KK Pretty Things beer. 1904 was Mary Poppins.
Right. Yeah.
Let's go back to Dave Geary. I got to talk to Dave.
Poppins.
Dave, tell us more. You know, you're one of our favorite brewers of all time. When did you last make a new style of beer or a new beer? You feel like you kind of figured it out.
7 months ago.
What did you make?
I made an IPA.
That's a new style.
Well, it's new for me.
Okay.
I made an Imperial IPA.
Really?
Yeah, I did, and I made a Scottish Wee Heavy, both 8% plus alcohol.
Was that available in this market? Or
yes,
just like
yes it is.
You have it. Wow, a double IPA.
Yeah.
I've got to try it.
It's 8.2% alcohol, and it's a beast. But getting back to hot, I want to just... add something about hops. The problem with 19th century recipes is that nobody knew what the alpha acid content was. So their 10 pounds of hops might be 3 pounds of hops with highly developed hops of today. So it's hard to know, because they had no way of measuring alpha acid. And so, you know, that's an unknown. It's
so are they genetically altering the hops today?
No, I don't think they're genetically.
Do you have to worry about that?
No, I don't think you have to worry about it at all. And
is Monsanto controlling the hop industry now?
Thank you for bringing it up. No, it's like how you develop big fat tomatoes, beefsteak tomatoes. It's careful breeding. And I've been to hop farms in England and watching them breeding hops, and how they do that, how they develop new breeds of hops, how they develop new breeds of barley.
I just picture this like Frankenstein kind of set with like a castle.
It's more like
lightning bolts.
When it was over, I wanted a cigarette because it was like breeding, and I thought, was it good for you too? But
okay.
No, this is development.
Humor.
I'm from Maine, you know. I don't have much to do in the winter.
Don't get out much.
We got to get you down here more.
Yeah, maybe we should go up to Maine more.
Yeah. But the point is that we don't know. We have such careful control of our ingredients now, And you look at the malt, the chemical analysis of the malt, we know exactly what we're getting as far as moisture, color, friability, soluble nitrogen ratio. We look at hops and alpha and beta acid levels. We know what those are, and there's no way they could have known that in the 19th century.
So when you made your new styles of beer for yourself, do you go and break down and do these studies, chemical studies?
Yeah, absolutely.
You do it ahead of time.
Well, and I teach my staff, my brewers, I teach them how to develop a new recipe. And how you develop a new recipe is really quite simple, if you know the process. You sit down with a calculator and a yellow pad and say, okay, what style am I making? So you decide on the style. What's its color going to be? What's its alcohol content going to be? What is the bitterness going to be? And all of those things are knowable with the ingredients that you have. And there are formulas. You just know. So, I mean, I think it's fair to say in 25 years, we've never done much of a test batch of anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know what we're doing. And we know, okay, I'm going to make an IPA, or I'm going to make a porter, or I'm going to make a Kolsch. I know the style. I know the ingredients. I know the parameters for the style to be appropriate, and I do it.
So you brew beer with a calculator and a yellow pad and a pencil?
Yep.
That sounds so romantic.
I use a pen.
A pen. Wow. Whoa.
But, you know, I know.
No safety net.
I know it's wacky, but I'm a rebel. But it is the way beer is done. And I read things, somebody says, well, they spent months test brewing. Well, they don't know what they're doing if they did that.
Wow.
Dave Broderick, please join in.
Well, I'm just wondering, when you did the Imperial IPA, was the process any different for it? Like, is it a more of an English style? I haven't tried it, and I would love to try it. And so I'm just wondering how, you know, what kind of Imperial IPA was it?
Well, I'm not sure there's any such thing as an Imperial IPA.
Thank you.
That's what I mean. Since there isn't.
But, you know, I looked around and looking at the handwriting on the wall and the tyranny of the hop, and I thinking, you know, people are making more and more. And it started on the West Coast because they smoke way too much Humboldt County Green Bud. It started on the West Coast. These under-fermented and over-hopped
hydroponic
beers.
Stuff.
They're bittersweet, but they're, for a small minority, particularly beer journalists, it's catching on that you've got to have these outrageous beers.
Yeah.
And so I said, all right, with a gun to my head, I made Imperial.
That's
IPA.
Why I'm very fascinated to try
and
your
what
version.
What was the response to that? Did people,
that people
like
loved
it?
That people, you know, the usual suspects loved it. I didn't like it at all. It's not a balanced
beer.
God
love those usual suspects.
Beer.
It's not about balance, is it?
Wait, no. Dave, no. Does this mean you're on the verge of getting bought out?
No.
What?
No, I'm waiting for the phone to ring.
I have this theory that once you make an Imperial IPA and you never made it before, it means you're about to get bought out. No?
My telephone still ain't ringing. I assume it's still ain't.
InBev, are you listening?
So now, was that a one-off beer, or is it now part of your lineup?
It's part of our lineup. It's year-round, sold in four packs, 8.2% alcohol, 98 IBUs. Once you get past 70, IBUs are meaningless anyway.
You can't
doesn't
tell,
mean anything.
Right. It just numbs you out.
I just made that number up to please the people at the Beer Advocate.
They're lovely folks over there.
They are. They're great.
They're doing
a great job promoting the industry. I love those guys.
And so, they really like their...
Wait, Dave, we got some plans for you right now.
Yeah.
Okay, let's say next summer in July, Good Beer Month, which our group, the Good Beer Seal, helps coordinate in New York. Would you like to come to New York and do a whole series of tastings and let everybody know more about Geary's?
Jimmy,
let them know what they're missing.
That's what I do. That's all I want to do is come to New York.
You want to come to New York in July?
And hang out with you guys?
In July.
In July.
I don't care.
You're not going to miss your Maine in July?
I think it's better if we go to Maine in July.
Now we're talking.
That sounds like a lot more fun, personally. I think we should
when can we do a show up in Portland, Maine?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
We can arrange that.
Yeah.
I think so.
Be careful. I might invite our listeners to come with us. We had promised
the whole studio host
a few months ago that we were going to go to San Diego. We had Stone and Smothers on, and We didn't get invited out to San Diego, so
nobody wants. I don't know if
we're
going
to get
trip.
Invited to Portland, but we can invite you to New York, and I can promise you.
I
that.
Accept.
Yes, July next year. Put it on your calendar. July Good Beer Month, Craft Beer Week in New York is. We're in the middle of it, but of course we're already thinking ahead. You know, Blind Tiger tomorrow night's got an awesome event with Sean Hill from Vermont. And DBA is going to have this awesome cask of KK by Pretty Things tonight. We've got events like a New York City Brewer's Choice tomorrow night. Beer Sessions radio host will be there on Thursday, excuse me.
On Thursday.
September 30th. Yeah,
why don't you tell us a little bit about that event, since we're actually going and I don't even know anything about it.
It's a pretty cool event. It's everything that we've been doing from
it's gonna be so much fun, Dave.
Good Beer Seal and Beer Sessions radio. We're able to talk to a couple of brewers, key brewers, like a Greg Hall from Goose Island. And they're like, hey, you know what? We would love to come to an event that's focused on the brewers. And we put out a few calls. And we've got Colby Chandler from Ballast Point. We got Jim Abel from Two Brothers. We got Craig Freimark, the young brewer at Six Point. You know, and a lot of Brian O'Reilly from Sly Fox.
And is there food?
Brian's coming down.
Oh, yeah, wow. Jeff O'Neill from Ithaca. We've got 20 brewers at this point, including a homebrew pairing. We've got Ben Granger from Beercraft. He's doing a homebrew pairing.
I read about that. Someplace.
And they're all paired with food. So we've got everything from Arrow's Oysters, my favorite oyster harvester out in Long Island. There's some interesting breads. There's cheeses. There's great performances making custom
pretzels. Is there live music, too?
There won't be live music. There's a very cool iPod mix.
We hate live
mix.
Music. It's okay.
Very cool iPod mix.
Just our theme song from the show.
By right. an Australian and rock over. And roll dude. But, you know, that's Thursday night. And, David, are you going to still be in town on Thursday?
I will not. Will there be nudity?
Yeah, you want to see brewers nude?
Unfortunately, yes.
Well, Greg Hall from Goose Island is the keynote speaker at New York City Brewers Choice, and I'll ask him to get nude for you.
Yeah,
but you got to stick around and go. It's too late.
sadly, I would, but
I told you guys could stay at my place. It's fine on 6th Street. You're welcome.
Stick around, but anyways, there's a lot of good things Bunk happening beds. This week, and you know, for many of us, we're already thinking ahead and. In particular, we should shout out to Pony Bar, because I know Pony Bar's got, they're going to have Garrett Oliver on Thursday night, and Rattle and Hum Bar has Beer Republic tonight, and Victory and Six Point Ales also, and there's some really great things going. This has really been a really good craft beer. What do you guys think of it? It's the third New York Craft Beer Week.
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of, you know, people cashing in their coupons.
I see a lot of coupons.
Yeah, so...
It's no, we've had a really good turnout.
Yeah, much more impact than last year.
Yeah, no, I know we had a dinner on Sunday night with Greenport and some small guys, Blind Bat and Barrier and Pretty Things. Tonight, Kelly Taylor from Kelso is at Jimmy's 43. Tomorrow night, we have a brewery dinner. And all this stuff just kind of came to us. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, 3 years in, suddenly it's like, wow, New York really does have a craft beer week.
Yeah, it's nice when the brewers are calling you like, hey, can we do an event tonight?
Yeah.
When it, like, the next day.
Even Ray's doing craft beer week.
Yeah, I know. I'm kind of getting to this whole beer thing. It's new to me.
They put a gun to his head.
They have good beer in New York? What?
Wow. That's it. You know, we stayed a little over because we had these two great brewers and Dave Broderick and everybody. And I'll give everybody a chance. Dave, you come down from Vermont once a month, and every time you do, my heart just like beats harder because you're the beer guy, man. If you want to meet a beer guy, it's Dave Broderick.
You know what? It's kind of awkward when Jimmy and Dave get together. You know, just being around, it's like
we make Ray uncomfortable sometimes.
Yeah, I do.
And Dave actually wears we have a special T-shirt. I like beer, which we're making.
I fly the flag. You know, look at you guys.
So Dave, just tell us one thing before we sign off. Tell us something about your month or what you're looking forward to.
I just actually went to Septemberfest up in Vermont, and which is I know. September. And it was all the little tiny Vermont breweries were there, and I think they limited to like 200 people. It was actually more like a party at Mad River Glen, the ski area. And then we went to an after party at the Hostel Tevaray, which is this new hostel, $30 a night you can stay there. And it was just really cool. I mean, all the brewers showed up. They brought special kegs to the hostel afterwards. You know, Sean Hill obviously was there, Sean Lawson, and Paul Saylor, and it was just the after party was just so much fun because, you know, you looked around, you knew almost everybody in the room, and everybody in the business. So those parties are always a good time.
That's great, man. It's great to have you. Shout out to everybody, Dan Paquette, Martha Paquette, Dave Geary, of course, and we'll thank our sponsors at greatbrewers.com, who also bring you Union Beer. They bring you Geary's. So if you want to try some really good beer, go to greatbrewers.com and ask them to sell more Geary's. And this is Beer Sessions Radio. Our producer, Bree O'Connor, Jack Inslee, engineer, Nat Wiener. And see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. Thank you.
To the point, roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer.